Thanks, Joe.
Hello, my name's Joe and I'm an addict.
Hey, Joe!
Is that marker off near enough?
Yep.
Yeah. Don't go lying, start. Chris told me I'm not allowed to start by saying I'm nervous, so I'm going to start off dishonest. I'm great. Start as you mean to go on. I'm not nervous, I'm tripping. Shit, I've been a piss four times. I try not to swear twice in the first line. That's nerves for you. I was just sitting in, I was thinking to myself, I like to think that I'm open-minded enough to take on a few suggestions, and I was in a Buddhist place the other day talking to a guy about anxiety, and he said, try and breathe and think about the soles of your feet, because anxiety rises, so if you think of the soles of your feet, it pulls it downwards, and I was just doing that, and it kind of worked. And pray. I try not to have an emergency god now. I try to play more regular, but I've still got to help this out. So that's my nerves out of the way. I'm Gerald, I'm an addict. Thanks for asking me, Chris. It'd be nice to see you turn up. I'd have given you a lift if I'd have known. I was asked before, Jay asked me before and it was cancelled. I'm not quite sure why that had happened, but it's nice to arrive. It sort of fell on a birthday week. I'm 14 years clean this week. Yeah. From the grace of God, thanks to the fellowship. And as corny as that might sound, it's true. Do you know what I mean? And my journey, I'm going to try and kind of sort of be honest, and the thing I sort of talk about of late, of what I've really kind of tuned into, what this program's about, is the giving and receiving of love. And that's the only reason that I ended up here. It's the only reason I've stood here, and it's the only reason I continue to come here, is because I come from a place, you know, I do talk a little bit about kind of my childhood and the way I sort of ended up there, because I think it's appropriate, it's my story. And I grew up in a house, there were seven of us in a two-bedroom flat. My mum had quite severe mental health issues that used to come out in all various different kind of displays of usually anxiety or violence. And my old man weren't far different really, but when we see him, when he weren't in jail or drinking around the house. And I grew up and a lot of stuff I talk about, I learnt here. You know, I've got a bit of clarity and a bit of understanding of why I'm here and what's gone on for me. And I learnt that here. So if I'm talking and it don't sort of make, you can sort of identify, but you don't completely understand it, stay around, it does kind of fall into place, you know. Because I've talked with a lot of kind of emotional literacy and sort of a bit of a self-awareness. And that's kind of... coming here, because when I was young, there's the two things I really suffered from. I had no emotional literacy, no self-awareness, and I was kind of dumb. I was a great talker. I could crack a joke, I could pull a stroke, I could have it with the boys, but I was dumb. Emotionally, I was always in a knot. It was all, you know, like different books or different theories, like, you know, AA talk about the kind of spiritual malady or discontent, the therapists talk about low self-esteem and feeling discomfort, and you know, whatever the different terminology for it, I had it. Do you know what I mean? You know, I didn't feel like other people looked. I didn't feel confident, well balanced. You know, in anything I'd done, I was faking it from the start. You know, and as life went on, I got better at faking it. Didn't change the fact that it was there, and that's why I think I struggled with the giving and receiving of love, because I created such a character that anyone that fell in love with me fell in love with a character. They didn't fall in love with me and who I was. It's what I displayed and wanted you to think and feel I was. And I knocked about a lot of characters were like that. So it was all kind of, we were all sort of playing the game. And really I was full of shame, guilt, remorse, even as a youngster, inadequacies. You know, all them feelings, you know, I weren't right, you know, and what I done was, is everyone in my family, I was the youngest, and I've got five brothers, it's quite dysfunctional, I've got one sister, got like five of us are from like the same mum and dad, and we've got one brother there that's from my mum and one brother's from my dad, so it was that sort of dysfunctional, and I was the youngest, what all the people above me were doing with this kind of disease and discomfort were taking drugs. You know, and as a little boy, watching these people doing it, it was a learned behaviour. What I'd done was I picked up a drug and I stuck it in me. And you know what? It fucking worked. Now, I remember going down to doctors. People talk about the end of their using, manipulating doctors. I was sent down to the doctor as a kid to manipulate them for Valium. I had all the symptoms of what you had for non-sleeping, Temazepam, Valium, as a kid. And I can remember we had an Irish doctor and he knew my family really well, and I remember him saying to us one day, he said, "What are they doing, making soup out of them up there?" The whole fucking family was on Valium, right? And drinking, that's what, and so I done it, and because you know what, I didn't know I was full of fear and anxiety, and I didn't know all this stuff was going on, but when I took the drug, I knew I felt better. You know, my sister went down to the doctor once, and my brother was going, "Oh, what you got to tell him?" My brother wanted speed, Dexedrine, or something. And he said, "Tell her you're really tired, you can't get out of bed, you're feeling depressed." He's giving me all the symptoms. You know, my oldest brother is a fuck. He's 16 years clean, by the way. He's a lot to do with the damage, not the illness it was in. But what they say, what did Chris say to me? The growth starts when the blaming stops, but I've got a bit of blame around him. But he sent his sister down the doctor with all these symptoms, and the doctor said, "The best thing I can prescribe for you is a job." So that was a sort of relationship. He was out of his nut. The doctor used to be phoning at his mouth. We knew, we asked to say, "What you prescribe? What if you're prescribing yourself, can I have some of it?" And that's how it was. And when eventually they gave us an house up in Evergreen, and it was like a lovely street with all nice edges, and like then they moved us in. This nutty Irish family who had a car engine in the garden, the edge was overgrown, the front door was off. Do you know what I mean? My mum used to say, "Leave a note on the side. If they come and find, like, because she said, we're going to get burgled, no front door." She said, "Leave the note. If they find anything, they leave us off." You know, we had fuck all and plenty of it, you know what I mean? The only thing in the fridge was the light. And that's how it was. And I adapted to it. And what I've done is I took drugs. And my mum was one of them people. There was kind of like sort of misfits around my estate, around my area. They'd always end up in my house. My mum was a caretaker. To the end of my using, she'd always be like, you know, there'd always be misfits in my house if they were my dad's mates or my brother's mates. And it was one of them houses. It was stolen goods always getting in and out. And we just took one drug to the next. And I was never happier than when I was out on the street. You know, I didn't realise that it was so horrendous indoors that I was happy on the street. I thought that's where I wanted to be, on the street corner with my mates. And, you know, talk about feeling shame, guilt, remorse. I knocked about with a gang of mates, and all we used to do was muller each other. You know, we'd meet each other, get stoned, and just take the piss out of each other. Like, if God forbid of anything, like, you had something against you, you were just left alone until we end up having a fight and making up again. And that was... And I learned about being an addict them days because I took a lot of drugs compulsively and obsessively before I even got to the drugs I liked. Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, I can remember smoking puff and not liking it and still smoking it every day and even nicking things to go and smoke it and I didn't even like it. You know, like you talk about in kind of NA, you go to the first NA dance and all your first meeting, you feel like self-obsessed and doing everyone's thinking for them and all that. That's what puff used to do to me, you know. You just come to an NA meeting clean. I just feel like that and just think, oh, but someone roll the joint. And I used to knock about with some really cranky people in some really cranky pubs, right? People you're just like, fucking nightmare, these people. And I used to take LSD with them. You know what I mean? It's like... And I'd have horrendous nights stuck in a corner, tripping out of the nut, and just, oh, this needs to end. And I'd get up and someone said, "Don't drink a carton of orange juice or something, like vitamin C." And like this horrendous trip, and I'd get up in the morning and go back to the same pub and say, "Someone want one of them?" And I'd go, "Yeah." Because I didn't know what I suffered from. And I used like that until I was 23. When I was 23, I went into a detox. I was a 7 1/4 stone. I had a severe anxiety disorder. I mean, I was never diagnosed with mental health, but I'm sure if there was a mental health worker about, there would have been a few diagnoses going down, do you know what I mean? But, I come from that place where they don't know. it's blatantly obvious, but I'll get through. Like, stick a pair of jeans, a pair of tracksuit bottoms under your jeans so the back pockets don't touch. Your arse don't look skinny, you know, and three shirts on in the summer with a woolly jumper over the top, choplifting, sweating, do you know what I mean? They ain't got a clue. I'm all right. Look, the state of you, you need to liven up, you, the fucking state of you. And what happened is how I ended up in this detox was by default. I'm always thankful this lady, Dee, that I've got a flat down the end of Evelyn Street, and I always share this story because it's kind of, it's appropriate to what I'm going to share about sort of programme of giving and receiving love, because this was just all chaos of just like one drug after the other, you know, and then drugs come along that I like ecstasy and the E-scene and heroin, and because no one liked that, did they? Heroin or anything. No one here liked them sort of drugs, and that come along and you know, and it done what it said on the tin. Like the rest of them, they worked. You know, I felt love. When I was in a club, eat up, and I was with my mates, and they hugged me, I felt, yeah, this is nothing. I feel the love, man. You know what I mean? Until you wake up in the morning, dipping each other's pockets. But I mean, at the time, but what happened is, I remember my brother, it's not about what drugs we take, it really ain't, it's just my experience I'm talking about. I can remember my brother, this sort of message I got, I remember him cutting up Charlie on a record cover once, giving me a sniff, and as he was cutting it, he said to me, you ever touch that brand fucking gear, I'll kill you. I went, oh, I guess that note then, I won't. You know, like, it was, you know, but I ended up getting on the gear. I can remember sort of feeling ashamed about it, and until my family kind of fell out, like, sort of found out, and that become acceptable. And, like, so, like, I was lucky, really, because I got the gift of desperation quite young. I was 23, and I used to walk past this drug project, and it was called Drugs in Deptford. I don't know why they called it that. You'd think we'd go and score there, wouldn't you? But I never used to go in, I used to just pass by, and there was this woman there, Dee. If I ever see her, God bless her, I've lost contact with her now, and down to my own journey, because I relapsed for 5 years afterwards, so I never come here and got it, do you know what I mean? I'll tell you a bit about that, but I used to walk past, and she used to come out and talk to me, and I used to have this route. There was a kind of African guy at the end of the road, had an off licence, and I used to cash my book there, my social security book, so he used to let me take a couple of tenants or scold supers every morning. When I was cashing my book, he'd cash me on the way out and take it, so I'd be like, That was the procedure, and I walked down to Drugs in Deptford and then off to the train station, and she used to come out and talk to me, this lady, and always sort of stopped me, and she'd see what state I was in. She was a drug worker, I had no sort of contact with drug workers, I never went in voluntary, and she used to come out and talk to me, and when I'd have a few Valium in me, a couple of drinks in me, a bit, I used to drive her fucking mad, really, excuse my language, talking like rubbish to her, and she used to talk about sort of kind of bits of recovery, and what really stuck with me, it's always stuck with me, is I had this Bull Terrier, right, and I really looked after it, a Staffordshire Bull Terrier. Yeah, the only pal I had left in the world, and he was really well looked after, right, and I can remember her saying to me one day, look at that dog, isn't he lovely, and I was going, yeah, and she was bigging this dog up, and she went, look at his fur, look, and I can remember breaking into a pet shop in Catford just to get the Uber Canuba food because someone said it was good. I remember the drunk one night walking home with bags of Uber Canuba, do you know, like for this dog. Oh, madness. And my flat was full of all this dog food and ointments, and I'd really look after this dog, do you know what I mean? She was telling me, look at his lovely teeth, it had the chewy bones, it was really well looked after, and she'd go, isn't he lovely? And I'd say, yeah, and she'd go, look at the fucking state of you. You ain't had no breakfast, you've got a can of beer in your hands. She went, look at that shirt, Colin, it's four sizes too big, yeah. It weren't when I bought it, you know, like, nothing like the crack cocaine diet, you know what I mean? And she just told me the truth. And what she said to me has always stuck with me. And it was the beginning of my recovery. Like, the first thing that ever got through to me, she said, you care more about that dog than you do yourself. And that was the truth. She went, you would not treat that dog the way you treat yourself. Look at the state of you, do you know what I mean? And somehow in the middle of a blackout, she signed me up for a detox. Love her, do you know what I mean? So, say you can't do it for you, but, you know, carried a message in the attic. But she carried me in there, and I turned up, and she let my mum know. My mum, like, it was bizarre. My mum would go and score on that with me. I'd go and cash me mum's book. And, you know, I mean, I was on the cigarette flight as soon as you could be on it. Like, all my family, my dad used to get 8 gyros. From like different offices, they were all paddies that come over, and I suppose a lot of foreigners are doing it now, but we were the first, the paddies. We made it up. So fair play to them when they're doing it, do you know what I mean? And
And that's the sort of upbringing. And he told my mum, and she told my mum that she'd sign me up. My mum used to come down, and my mum, bless her, used to come down. And when you're getting cured, that's what she used to say. Look, I don't know, I'm waiting to get in. When you're getting cured, I said, guess it's 10, I'm going to get cured soon. I will, I'll get cured. So I believe there was a cure. That's the insanity of it. And I ended up in this detox. And what happened was, when I was in this detox, two people from NA come round. And they come round and done a chair, and they shared their experience, and they left. But what happened to me was, it wasn't what they said, it wasn't the readings, it wasn't, I can remember thinking, alcohol's not a drug, I ain't giving up the drink, do you know what I mean? I remember a guy in Lewisham said to me once, I used to sell him stuff in the market store, he says, that can glue to your hand. I went, what? He went, I've never ever met you without one of them in your hand, ever. 8 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock at night, you've always got a can in your hand, do you know what I mean? And these guys come round and they left, but what stuck with me, they looked all right. They'd shared the stuff I was talking about, but they looked comfortable. And like I could fake it or take the piss or put someone down or tell the counsellors how to do their job or cause a kick-off in the detox. But they looked all right. They had nothing to prove. They told their story and they left. And I really believe that attraction and rather than promotion, something that had, that NA thing, got me that night. Really did get me. You know, if you'd have asked them when they left, they'd have probably said, he's got no chance. Right? But it got me. And I carried on going to meetings from then. But what I didn't realise is I've got an illness of denial, but I have to be vigorously honest with myself to get well. So I was in like a kind of hopeless dilemma, really. I had to be really honest with myself, but yet I had an head that told me lies. So I was kind of, it was another, you know, we probably recognised that place, you know, and I was full of clever answers and denial. And what happened, I was used for 5 years in and out of rooms. And I really feel for the newcomer, you know. People say, just do your 90, come in, that. But like, it was horrendous for me coming to meetings. Because what happened, when they took all the drugs away, all that stuff when I was a kid come back, all that low self-worth, all that inadequacy, all that shame, all them feelings were back there. I felt less than people, you know. And to walk in a room of people, hello, mate, all right. It was horrendous for me. I found it really difficult, you know, I didn't know I suffered with nails, I didn't know it was a condition, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just come in and didn't feel how you looked. And I went back to what I always done. I took a drug for the ease and comfort. You know, and it worked, but what happened is the periods of it working got shorter and shorter because I was hearing stuff in here and the denial was getting broken down. And I ended up using the last time for a month. Funny enough, John come and got me. And I was in my flat down in Deptford and I'll never forget it because it was one of them flats where everyone gave you a bit of something. So, like, brown city, green carpet, blue curtains. You know, like the charity case fucking flat. You know what I mean? When I think about it, and I went and got two pots of green paint. And I said, that's it, I'm going to go and paint the flat and get off the gear. Right, I'm going to clug it out. And I went and got institution green. You'd only ever seen this paint in an hospital or a prison. You would not see this paint anywhere else. Right? And I wonder why it was about a five or a ten, you know what I mean? They probably donated to the prisons. It's something familiar. I took it home and I started painting the flat and withdrawing. And then there was a knock on the door. I said, fuck me, I looked out the window, it was N.A. creeping around my flat, right? NAPD, three NA members knocking on the door looking at me. I was up against the wall, fucking come and get me, you know that? And I was diving about and shouting through the letbox, we know you're in there, we can see you. I weren't even piping, you know what I mean? Same behaviour under the window. Fucking hell, they're coming and get me, NA's at the door, what do I do? They're going, open the door. So I've opened it, come in. I'm obviously like ashamed of myself, I'm withdrawing, I'm about 8 stone, I'm clucking, and they look all well, pulling up in motors, yeah, do you want to come for me? No, I don't really. Leave me alone. And they went and got me a bacon sandwich, sat there, and what happened was two of them are still clean, one of them wasn't. He said to me, I've got a load of DFs up my ass, the hydrocodone, I'll run up and get them for you now, because you look like you're in bits. And I said to him, there's no point, because for the first time in my life, I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew the drugs weren't the answer. Mm-hmm. I knew that there was something seriously going on for me that was wrong. Little bits of NA. I was still undiagnosed, but I knew that the drugs weren't going to make it any better. For the first time in my life, I said no. And that was the last time I used. I ain't used since that was 29th of January 2000. That was like 14 years Wednesday. And I ain't used. And I went to the Camberwell meeting, and I think from then on, I took this seriously. I went in there and I can remember someone saying to me, well, fucking state of you. But the first thing I done was I asked for help. I sat next to someone and said, what the fuck do I do? What do I do? I said, I don't know what to do. And I knew that, like, and he said, look, just don't use the day. Get your head on the pillow tonight. Don't worry about next week, next month. Don't worry about what your head's saying, what you're thinking and feeling. You're welcome here. Get your head on the pillow tonight. You've got half a chance. You know what's in store. Do you know what I mean? And I heard that, and I can remember, like, sort of white-knuckling it, getting home, getting in the house, walking about the house at night, maybe trying to get a couple of hours, getting up in the morning, going straight to a meeting. I went 3 meetings a day for 6 months, and I met this guy, and I asked him to sponsor me, and it was really interesting. I wish I could do what he'd done to sponsees, but what he'd done to me, he gave me the biggest gift in recovery, he gave me willingness. He tested my willingness. He said, I'll tell you what, I met him, he said, I'm at the Brixton meeting every Sunday. He said, I'll put the chairs away. He said, come up to the meeting, help me put the chairs away, and I'll let you know. So the week's gone by. He said, mate, you do a meeting every day. I've got out there Sunday, I'm putting the chairs away. I said, yeah, what do you want? Like, you sponsor me. Like, I'm in fear and I'm asking for help, first time in my life. I want, what do you need, mate? Do you know what I mean? He's gone, he went, no, you tell you what. He said, I ain't spoken to my sponsor. I'll be at Red Post Hill Wednesday. I'll put the chairs away down there. We'll clean up and that, kiss an hand. When I'm putting the chairs away, I'll talk to my sponsor, I'll let you know. So I've gone down there, putting the chairs away. Mate, what do you reckon? You look. He went, I forgot to ask him. He said, I'm at Camberwell Saturday. He said, I'm at Camberwell Saturday. And I went, I'm fuming now. I've gone from low self-worth to anger. This is taking the piss. Don't he know who I am? Don't he know I've got a multicoloured flat? So, this has gone on, right? This has gone on for about 4 or 5 meetings. So the last meeting, I'm putting the chairs away. I said, you taking the piss? He went, no. He said, there's no point sponsoring unless you're willing to go to any lengths. He said, I'll take you on. He said, do you want to come do a chair at the detox for me Wednesday? And I said, yeah, come pick me. No, I won't come pick you up. He said, you get the so-and-so bus from there to there. I said, but you go past me. He said, have I taught you something? And I was fucking fuming. But I started putting footwork in. I went and done it, even though I felt I had nothing to say, and I went in and then he invited me up to his house and we started to go through the book and then he taught me about the illness I suffered from and why I was the way I was and why I used the way I used, and it started to make sense. Do you know what I mean? He started to help me diagnose myself. Do you know what I mean? And I think if you're here and you're not quite sure what you suffer from, make it your business to find out, because I couldn't have that complete freedom, because I'd be in meetings and they go, the obsession and compulsion to use drugs has left me. That's all right. I'm glad you fucking, what time's your itch? I hope I walk past it tonight without having one, because I felt so bad I needed to stick one in me. Do you know what I mean? And when I realised, I knew anyway, that day when he went to give me them DFs, I knew the drugs weren't the answer. I knew. And what happened was, once he sort of talked me about this illness, and I don't want to get all technical with you, but once I knew about it, and it was my responsibility, and I knew what would happen, the freedom come. I stopped thinking and obsessing about ways and means to use drugs. I kind of accepted it, and then I'd done a step two of him. We sat down, and I said, what's all this higher power and this insanity? And he went, well, this is it. Me and you sitting here is as good as it gets. Me and you together, you're not on your own. Me and you together are a power greater than your illness. You sitting here tonight, you've got half a chance. And what he was teaching me about then was about love. You know, something you ain't got in your life that you need, like food and water, to deal with this addiction is love. You know, and even though he was showing me, I didn't quite know how to receive it or go and give it to someone else, but he was showing me that enough amount of love that I could believe that I could stay clean and sober. And I continue to continue to kind of work through the steps, and I continue to do what I've needed to do. And I continued, I've done an inventory and I've looked at myself, I trusted the rest of the programme, and I just took it all on board. And I always like to share, really, because I'm aware I'm running out of time, but I always like to share sort of around step 6 and 7, really, because I think until I got really involved in understanding what 6 and 7 meant, I could never really truly, kind of completely be comfortable with myself. As uncomfortable as it was looking at it, they give me the tools to be the person that I wanted to be, or a choice of a person. I didn't realise I had a choice about how my self-esteem, how right it would be, all them awkward feelings. I didn't know I had some tools to actually choose that stuff, that I could be loving and caring or the opposite, and then wonder why I feel less than, because I ain't been behaving right. And I ain't even looked at why I ain't behaving right, because I've been fronting it, I've been this, and all of a sudden my self-esteem's taking a chip, and then my head starts speeding up, and I don't even know this has gone on. Do you know what I mean? I'm walking about off my head and don't even know it. At least when I started working in the 6 and 7, and like a sponsor recently said to me, look, your step 6 is like what you think and feel, yeah? Your step 7 is when you behave on it, you know? And it gave me a stopgap. Yeah, I might feel angry, but I ain't got to chin someone. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know that. You know, you might annoy me, but I ain't got to tell you, you know, what about yourself. You know, I can feel the anger and have a look at myself, and you know, and I kind of went for that process for ages, and it was quite painful to start looking at the way I really was. You know, I had to do 4 and 5 to get the tools to do that. And what's happened is, it's given me the tools now to be the person that I want to be or not be. I'm not saying I get it right, because I've got the tools. Doesn't mean my self-esteem don't go backwards. I don't go off my head, but at least I've got a choice. The responsibility is not just about using drugs. I've got responsibility about how I behave or how I want to be. Because if I'm in bits and my head spin, it's no one else's fault. Unless it's my old woman's. We all know that one, don't we? There's got to be a bit of blame somewhere, surely. But do you know what I mean? And I've continued to do that. And I've just kind of come to the end of the road with a kind of sponsor recently. And I've spoke to a guy this week, and he said he can't sponsor me. And then my mate, when I've got this fella up out of the way, he'll take you with the steps again. And I rang him, I don't even know him, and I'm going to go through the steps with him in 3 days next week, again, just as a refresher. And I thought, I'm so glad I've still got that willingness to go there, have a look at myself. Because I've had a difficult year. I was prescribed painkillers at the beginning of this year. Spoke to Mark, spoke to a few people about them. You know what I've realised? My illness don't care if they're prescribed or not. My illness does still not know. They still give me ease and comfort, and they still set off the kind of phenomenal kind of insanity within myself. Do you know what I mean? And then what happened was my self-esteem went, the shame went, I want to keep it secret, and the illness was on me. And I've had to break fear out, I've had to deal with pain. And you know what? I end up seeing a top professor in pain relief in King's College, right? This woman, she's an old woman, about 70-odd years of age, really wise woman. You know what she prescribed me in the end? She said, I want you to write down all the things you get angry about at night, right? She went, all the things you worry and stress about, all your fears, right? And she went, so what she prescribed me was a step 10. And then she went, right? Seriously, this is what this woman, and I said, so I started talking to her. I said, you'd like to know about 12 steps when I've heard about them. I said, do you anything? She went, no. She went, and then you've got to learn to meditate to quiet your mind for it. She prescribed me 10 and 11. I swear, I sit here, and I've gone through pain clinics, every doctor in the land to get to this top professor. And she said, look, you're stressed out and angry. Do you know what I mean? You need to start working on this stuff. And then what's realised is I was kind of, I had a sponsor by name, but not by nature. We were like mates and talked to each other. It wasn't practically working. It had become, so I'm going to go back and do that. And where I am in my life now is that the biggest gift in my life now and the biggest reflection about anything is I got married in recovery, and I've had three children. They've never seen me use. They're 6, 7 and 8, 3 boys, Tommy, Joe and Ted. And they're gorgeous. They're handsome little boys. They're really good little footballers. They're confident. They don't front it. They're well-rounded. They talk about how they feel. You know what? I don't know if, you know, they say this illness runs in the family. I heard someone say, no, not in mine, it gallops. Do you know what I mean? And for the first time, I look there and I get this fear and this anxiety. I look at them and I think, they've got the isms, is it in them? Like, fuck, oh no, I couldn't go through it. But the thing is, they don't look like I felt when I was a kid. And I can only put that as a reflection of this and the way I am because of this. That, you know what? Without no shame, fear or anything, I'm putting my hand on my heart and say, I'm a really good dad. And I don't need anyone else to tell me that. And I ain't got a dad. I'm a good dad. I show up. They wear kickers to school, you know what I mean? That was important to me, mate, because when I went to school, mate, and I was the only kid with an old in my trainers, do you know what I mean? And they go, we're going gym now, and I think, I've got no pants and I ain't going gym. No, the shame, you know what I mean? They ain't got that, do you know what I mean? They ain't got that, you know, they're progressing well in football. I cut them in an academy now. I take them football 2 days a week. I've done my coaching badges and I coach with them. And it's not because I want them to become professional footballers, it's because we talk about that, we get up together, we go there together, because it's, someone sent me, it's a really good gift. Gary Witch went to me, you know, your kids are like newcomers. He said, all they want is your time. He said, you know, they don't want clever words. They don't. You ain't got to be nothing special. All they want is your time. And my kids, I have a work, I'm with my kids, to a point where my mates go to me, where are you? Because, I, you know, maybe I'm, I may be a little bit, but that's where my life is. And if you look at my kids' life, to pair it to mine, something massive has gone on. Because all my furniture matches. Yeah? They're loved. They're loved, you know what I mean? They don't walk around the house in fear. They don't feel like they've got to stick something in themselves to feel better. You know, I educate them on, like my boy the other day, my wife's gone, I've come home with big bits of salmon, you know, like fish, and I'm talking about, check that, you ain't going to get them eating that. Do you know what I mean? She come home, they eat the lot. Because all I've got to say is, Juro eats it. How do you think he's so big? Or you should pick a football player they like and say, see him, you'll never be as strong as him unless you eat that. They go, cash. Do you know what I mean? No, I need Mark for a few more tips. The fellowship's got everything. But, I don't know what to say. I'm really grateful. I mean, I'm really grateful to be 14 years clean. I'm really grateful to feel all right about who I am. You know, when I walked in this room, right, apart from the fear of doing a chair, I remember coming into rooms, and over the years it's been different. I come in with resentments, which make me ill. I come in, people on a pedestal, obviously, me self-esteem. But I come in, you know what, and I actually felt all right. There was no, like, all right, we're not all, like, pals, and but there's no one I'm really, like, there's nothing too much going on apart from the normal human stuff. You know, and I don't feel I have to change myself in any way. I'm all right. And that's all I ever wanted, to be all right. I'm lovable, you know, I hope to believe that I can give a little bit of love where I can. I get a list in the morning. I write down all the people I need to phone that day. Somewhere along the line, they get a phone call, you know, just to connect. And, you know, they're not because I want this or want that. There's a few people I always phone, how are you? New people add to the list. He's all right, he can come off the lift. I don't really phone women, you know. We've all got the odd potential, so all the people I connect with. No, I'm honest with myself, you know. I don't want that stuff in my life. I'm a married man with kids, so I stick with the men in the fellowship. I don't have no real contact with many women. Some of them looked to one and went the other day, and he don't like me. He's really rude. I said, no, it's not about you, honestly. You're all right. You're all right, believe me. Yeah, I'm not. You know what I mean? You stay over there. Let me go and ring me mate. You know what I mean? It's, I try and live all right, is what I'm saying. Not that I'm perfect, but I try and live all right, you know. And I don't know really much more to say that. I'm just grateful to be clean, and I hope someone got something of what I said. I'll leave it there. Thanks.